I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. The golden age of TV continues with smart and sophisticated shows and series for just about every taste. If you're a history buff, there was Ken Burns' documentary series on PBS, The Vietnam War, and The Crown on Netflix about Queen Elizabeth and the underside of the royal family. If you are a fan of the dystopian, there was the adaptation of Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu. There were shows about death and disappearance and the afterlife, HBO's The Leftovers and The Good Place on NBC, a Western Godless on Netflix that I thoroughly enjoyed, and the highly anticipated Twin Peaks, The Return on Showtime. Today on Radio Times, the best TV shows of 2017, according to our guests and you. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Sam Adams. He's senior editor of Slate's culture blog called Browbeat. Sam, it's been many years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. And joining us by telephone, she got up very earlier this morning, is Sonia Saraya, and she's TV critic for Variety. Sonia, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
Sonia, as you look back over 2017 and you look at all the TV shows that you have probably watched over this year, what's your impression? Were there certain themes that you saw that TV was dealing with?
Yeah. I think that this is a year of seeing a lot of women's narratives really come to the forefront. And that's something that TV's been good at for a number of years. But this year in particular, it seems like it was really pronounced. You know, several of the shows you mentioned are really female-centric.
Yep.
And it's kind of, it feels like a little bit revolutionary.
How about for you, Sam, as you look back over the year, certain themes that jump out at you?
Yeah, I mean, one of the themes that came up or one of the things that I found a lot of my favorite shows have in common is they're just, you know, TV is so, there's so much of it. It's so kind of diverse in tone and form and everything else. And I found that they're just, the things that really grab me are things that have just kind of abandoned the idea of a narrow audience in a lot of ways and really done something very specific that probably would have gotten them about three episodes until they were canceled
right.
10 or 15 years ago. So this, you know, very, you know, sort of specific idiosyncratic approach to making things and either being able to find an audience because there's just so many people watching TV now or not being concerned with it because the economics of the business have shifted so much.
Oh, that's so both of those. So interesting. Well, let me play a scene from Twin Peaks. This is The Return, Showtime's remaking, I guess, or the reimagining of Twin Peaks. And of course, this is the 1990 series created by David Lynch and Mark Frost. I should say that both of our guests put this on their top, I guess, 20 or 10 or 15 TV shows of the year. Tracy is played by Madeline Zima, is being shown a mysterious secret room by Sam, who's played by Ben Rosenfield. This is a glass box he describes as one of the big mysteries in this surrealist drama.
What is that thing?
A glass box.
Yeah, but what's it for?
I really don't know. It's just a job I got to help with school.
Whose place is this?
I heard a billionaire. Some anonymous billionaire.
Mysterious.
I'm supposed to watch the box and see if anything appears inside.
What? Do things appear?
I haven't seen anything since I started. But the guy I replaced, he saw something once.
What?
He wouldn't tell me. Or couldn't tell me. We're not supposed to say anything about this place or that glass box.
The first episode of Showtime's Twin Peaks, The Return. Sonia, you described it as weird, creepy, slow, and interesting. What did you like about this series?
Oh, I just loved how unexpected it was. I mean, you know, it's an 18-hour miniseries that concludes, expands upon, and then concludes David Lynch's original Twin Peaks from the early 90s. It's very strange. We're talking about, like, a very bizarre journey through different dimensions and a little bit of time travel, and I just loved it. I loved how experimental it was. David Lynch is a master, and it really comes out in how he manages to make these very, like, empty, almost spare scenes into something that's, like, really terrifying and engrossing. And it really didn't make a lot of sense, and I think that that was why some other viewers were like, oh, no, this is not fun at all.
Right.
And I actually really enjoyed how twisted it was, and it definitely had that edge of horror that that he is so well known for.
Sam, you described it as visually striking. Of course, that doesn't necessarily work on the radio. but what did you like about this?
I mean, it's funny. I was just kind of giggling to myself as you were playing back that scene, which is, I think, from the very first episode, because isn't something I clued into right away. But listening back to it now, the idea of kind of staring at this glass box and, like, wondering when something's going to happen is such an obvious metaphor for watching these 18 hours of Twin Peaks itself. You know, as Sonu said, I mean, it was Lynch and Mark Frost, his co-creator, really kind of stretched things out and clearly had an 18-hour plan when they started this thing, and they weren't kind of making it up as they went along. You know, TV is so lousy with remakes and reboots now, and this was, you know, Twin Peaks wouldn't exist if it weren't for that. This is a, you know, cult TV show that had only grown in reputation in the 26 years it was off the air. But the show also kind of just blew up a lot of those expectations. Like, if you're just waiting for Agent Cooper to get back to Twin Peaks, you would have had to wait about 3 months in real time watching it. And it just took these incredible visual and narrative risks. Part 8, which kind of traces the origins of the show's kind of mythical evil back to the explosion of the first atom bomb in New Mexico in 1945, was just basically kind of smuggled an experimental film onto a cable TV. It's just this incredible kind of mind-blowing thing that is really, there's almost no point in trying to describe in words, especially on the radio, as you said. But I'm always wanting TV to take more risks, given, you know, as I said, how much the business has changed, how much the almost limitless possibilities there are. And this is a show that, you know, swung and missed a good amount of the time, but really was out there trying to do things that I don't think any other show on TV has attempted.
Well, let me make make a segue. This is to BoJack Horseman. Both of you like this show. This is season 4, episode 2 of this Netflix animated series. And in this episode, washed up actor BoJack Horseman, who's voiced by Will Arnett, is trying to escape into anonymity. He finds himself at his grandparents' abandoned house and uses it as a psychological exercise to revisit early trauma. Here, BoJack is fixing up the house with a fly who lives in the neighborhood.
I have to ask, are you
BoJack Horseman? No.
What? Who's BoJack Horseman?
Who's BoJack Horseman? He's a very famous TV and film star. Or he was. Yeah, before he gave it all up for a life of quiet anonymity. Where is he? Nobody knows. Perhaps a small town just like this one. Perhaps he's even in this very room. But he's not, because I'm not BoJack Horseman.
Okay.
So, Sonia, I know you like this. What did you like about it?
I'm just laughing at that clip.
It's funny.
BoJack Horseman is such a weird animated show. I feel a little bit bad because both of the shows I've endorsed so far, like, the first thing I say is that they're really weird. But I think that unexpectedly, this, like, animated show that stars a lot of animals in, like, human clothes is, like, one of the sharpest commentaries on Hollywood and celebrity that I think I've seen. And that's a great example of it. BoJack, who's voiced by Will Arnett, is you know, a sitcom star from the 90s who is trying to make sense of his life. There's a part of him that really wants to escape and to become anonymous, but then there's also a part of him that is always desperate for that validation, so he can't stop himself from telling everyone, like, oh, well, I'm super famous, but I'm not that guy.
I've met people like that before.
Exactly.
Sam, do you think it's easier for animals to talk about controversial subjects?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that this show does really well is it kind of, especially at the beginning, kind of brings new life to what has, you know, become this kind of, you know, sort of tired genre of this, you know, successful, washed up man, although he's actually a horse, you know, who's, you know, successful but doesn't have kind of love in his life and is kind of all this kind of past psychological damage. And it really brings new life to that through, you know, recasting the roles with a horse and a golden retriever and a cat and various other animals. And it's become, over the course of four seasons, it's increasingly kind of emotionally deep, occasionally really devastating, and experimental as well. There are a number of episodes in this season. The one that you played a clip from has a bunch of these kind of, you know, scenes from the past that are taking place effectively on the same stage where the character Bojack is kind of sitting in his family's house. There's one later in the season, the 11th episode, which is kind of seen through the eyes of his mother, who is kind of entering the late stages of Alzheimer's dementia. And so that episode kind of hops around in time and is very much kind of tries to find a animated analog for, you know, what Alzheimer's does to your memory.
Sounds sad.
Yeah, it's very sad. It's also very funny. There's a lot of – it's really dense with kind of, you know, puns and silly jokes and things like that as well. But I do think, you know, if the show were done with real people, I think it would be almost impossible to watch. And I think being animated and having these kind of anthropomorphized characters on it allows it to go into places that would be, you know, pretty tough to take and presented in a different form.
Do you agree with that, Sonia?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that there's just so many visual jokes in the show, too, that it relies so much on seeing these characters both as animals and as people, and then also, like, really kind of eviscerating some of their preconceptions. And the fact that it is an animated show really makes that possible, as Sam was saying. It's really hard to imagine how it would get into, you know, like, for example, there's an episode this season that's entirely... It's Bojack's internal monologue. Like, it's how he berates himself when he does things that are wrong, and just the way that he conceives of his own guilt or his own shame. The fact that they can do that in animation and make that so visually interesting is what makes it work. You know, it's really hard to imagine it working in the live action sense.
So interesting. Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to Sonia Saraya, TV critic for Variety, and Sam Adams, senior editor of Slate's culture blog called Browbeat, talking about the TV of 2017. Kathy says Mindhunter, except the first episode, a show that she liked from this year. What do you want to tell our listeners about? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Sam Adams and Sonia Saraya about the TV shows that we loved in 2017 on my list: Godless, American Crime, Narcos, Handmaid's Tale, Mindhunter, The Crown, The Deuce, The Americans, the Salman Rushdie fatwa story in Curb Your Enthusiasm, and several others there. I put Fargo, although I might take it off. I'm a little ambivalent about that. But we want to hear from you, and I've got some more comments here. A comment from Billy: it's shocking how underrated this year's installment of Fargo has been. It's a complex allegory of the modern political climate where the value and the very concept of truth itself is called into question, and unintended consequences lurk around every corner. Billy, I might put it back on my list based on what you just said there. Sonia, anything you want to say about Fargo?
Well, you know, I think that Bill is right, that it's probably underrated, and I think that part of the problem is that, and this is where like the hazards of this job come into play. There's so much that even I haven't seen all of it, and I haven't had a chance to watch this new season of Fargo. partly because, you know, it lost me a little bit in the, I think it was the second season, and then I just never got back to it. And there are so many other things, and we live in an era where there's more television shows than ever, and sometimes you can sort of justify to yourself skipping a third season or something. But of course, people really like them, viewers really like them, and I think this speaks to just how many options we all have right now. And I feel like everyone is wading through them. So I wish I had more to say about Fargo, is what I'm trying to say.
Fair enough. Sam, the hazards of being a TV critic, right?
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
You just can't see everything.
No, you cannot. No.
Even TV critics can't see all this good TV.
No, I mean, and that's, you know, sort of the glory of it now. I mean, there's just this sort of endless, you know, bucket of riches that you can dip into, and there's always something that, you know, someone will recommend that you haven't seen. And that's not counting, you know, the, you know, 50, 60 years of previous stuff that we often have access to as well.
Let me play, and this was on your list, Sonia, and this is Big Little Lies. I have to admit that I binge-watched this yesterday. This is from episode 6 of HBO's Big Little Lies, and in this scene, Madeline, played by Reese Witherspoon, is confronting her daughter Abigail, who's played by Catherine Newton, about her plan to sell her virginity and donate the profits to Amnesty International. Let's give it a listen.
Look, I don't even know where to begin about this, so I'm just going to go straight to the end. This is wrong, Abigail. Completely wrong. And I salute your cause. I really do.
But what? Saluting a cause? Recognizing a problem isn't enough. A person has to do something.
Well, this something is not that, honey.
What about your play?
What about my play?
You said it spoke to you because it was about finding a purpose in life, which I get.
Making your mark. I get that.
You're the one who always said a person's life needs to matter.
Okay.
Was it all just bullshit?
No, it's not. And I'm not going to give you some long song and dance about how precious and sacred your beautiful body is. Mm-hmm. But it is not for sale, Abigail. Not ever. No matter what cause, no matter what cost. And one day, you are going to look back at this, probably pretty soon, and think, what the f*** was I thinking? Why was I going to f*** up my life like that?
Just be nice to be so right.
I'm not right.
It's perfect.
I'm not perfect. You think you know me so well? I f*** up too. I make mistakes. I've made mistakes bigger than this.
A scene from Big Little Lies. Sonia, it's on your list. As I said, I watched it yesterday, and it's kind of The Real Housewife meets In Treatment meets The Affair, but somehow it really works.
Oh, yeah, I think it's fantastic, yeah. And you can hear Reese Witherspoon in that scene and how angry and entitled and her character, she plays, her character is named Madeline Martha McKenzie, and she's like a 40-something mother of two, and her whole life is really in this this pose of motherhood, this performance of motherhood in this wealthy enclave of Monterey in California. And I think that she, in that scene, you can hear her when she's talking to her daughter, like some of the facade is cracking a little bit. But there's so much in this story about how the cult of motherhood requires like a certain performance, certain behaviors, and especially when it comes to these like very wealthy women who arguably have everything they could want, how they have this discontent and these things to prove that turn into these rivalries with each other is really fascinating. And there's a mystery to Big Little Lies, which is one of the reasons it's so easy to watch quickly, as you did, Marty.
I did.
But there's also so much really extraordinary character work. You know, Nicole Kidman is the award-winning, the Emmy-winning story there. But everyone in it is really good, including Reese Witherspoon, Alexander Sarsgaard. It's a great show.
And the kids are really good, and there are these parallel stories between what's happening in this you know, very fancy first grade class and what's happening among the women, the moms in this story. Let me get Nick from Kensington to join us on Radio Times. And Nick, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. For taking my call.
You're welcome.
Super glad that both your guests love Twin Peaks as much as I did. But I was calling because I thought the show Big Mouth on Netflix was really, really good. And I haven't seen it get a ton of coverage or be on many lists, but I thought it was really funny, and I also hope that a lot of kids find it, because I think it addresses puberty in a really real and unfiltered way that might have been helpful to me and a ton of other people to see when I was a kid.
Oh, interesting. And Nick, only because we don't have a great phone line, you said Big Mouth? Is that what you're calling it?
Yeah, Big Mouth. It was Nick Kroll, John Mulaney, and I think a writer from Family Guy created it, and it's on Netflix. It's a cartoon.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Sam, do you know about Big Mouth?
I know about Big Mouth. That is one of the one of those spirit willing, flesh weak cases for me. But it is literally in my queue. So
is it? Oh, there you go.
Hopefully, in one of those weeks when I have nothing else to watch, which will never happen. So but I would love to get to it. Yeah, go. Sorry, go ahead. Sorry.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say I've watched a little bit of it, and I have to say I've never seen so many animated penises in my entire life. It's an animated show about puberty, and it is really quite intense. Points about how it depicts what the kids are going through. I think Nick is right. I think that kids going through puberty are gonna get a lot out of it. But it's also I think that it's provocative and maybe that's really important. But I think that's probably the reason we're not seeing a ton of it on end of year list. The people I know who have seen all of it really love it. But it does require a little bit of the hurdle of getting past the shock, I think.
Well, speaking of penises, let me play the first episode of Netflix's American Vandal. Sam, this is on your list. It's a series. It's a documentary style, sort of like Making a Murderer, The Jinx, even Serial. And in it, a undisciplined student named Dylan Maxwell is blamed for spray painting the cars of 27 teachers with the same obscene image. I think people will know what we're talking about. And a student documentarian seeks to find out if Dylan is, in fact, the person who committed the crime.
The vandal spray painted obscene images on 27 cars in the staff parking lot, causing an estimated $100,000 in damages. As of now, investigators have no leads.
As soon as I heard about the I knew.
This is what Dylan does.
Dylan's a burnout loser. Of course he did it.
Dylan Maxwell is the stupidest kid I've ever met.
He's a idiot.
This is not an isolated incident. Dylan has a history of this kind of behavior.
Dylan.
I know for a fact that this administration has exhausted all other disciplinary options with Dylan. For the sake of the other students and their learning environment, I strongly recommend that you vote to expel Dylan Maxwell for vandalizing the 27 vehicles.
All right, Sam, take it away.
American Vandal is, I guess, an 8-episode miniseries on Netflix, which, you know, Netflix itself has done so much to push forward this kind of boom in true crime investigative series that kind of started, you know, on the radio with Serial and then moved into Making a Murderer on Netflix. And this sort of subgenre has now matured to the point where it actually gets its own parody. So this is kind of starts off as, you know, a theoretical project made by these kind of high school AV club students who are trying to investigate this mystery of who sprayed in these things on the teachers' cars in the parking lot during lunch. And it's kind of almost wants you to underestimate it at first and just think this is, you know, deliberately built around this very kind of stupid, juvenile and very funny joke that it keeps repeating. And then it really matures into this pretty brilliant deconstruction of what's, you know, at stake in this whole mini genre. It really, you know, copies the kind of the visual and look of it. And you can even hear like the score on that clip. There's this great credit sequence with this kind of, you know, ominous melancholy cello underlying it.
I can hear it now.
Yeah, and there's a bit, just to, you know, skip forward a little bit, but there's a bit in the fifth episode where it kind of starts to turn in on itself, and you realize that the students have been actually releasing this documentary as they've been making it. So it becomes not only about the documentary, but about the documentary going viral, and there's a sequence where they kind of reconstruct this, what they call like Nana's party that they threw at someone's grandmother's house through going through all the kids' Snapchat videos and tracing the progress of the sort of this key piece of evidence through all the videos. And really just it's kind of a brilliant bit of assemblage. It really makes you think about kind of how all these little pieces of ourselves that we're kind of leaving around unintentionally strewn across various social networks, you know, and it ends up in a pretty like weighty place in a weird way, but it also it's just incredibly funny. The performances are just just perfectly in the pocket, and it really nails the thing that it's going after.
And that thing is American Vandal on Netflix. And that's Sam Adams, senior editor of Slate's culture blog, Browbeat. Sonia Saraya joining us by telephone, and she's TV critic for Variety. Did you want to add something to that, Sonia?
Oh, I think Sam described it beautifully, but I also really, really enjoyed American Vandal. You know, something surprising about it, it's produced by the same team behind the Funny or Die videos that are frequently viral on the internet. And the fact that they both transformed what is essentially like a gag into a show, what's amazing about it is how much that expands from being something that is essentially just a parody into something really human, I mean, with a lot of heart. And I think that, you know, as someone who's a little bit critical of some of the docuseries that have become really famous, like Making a Murderer, it's kind of shocking that this show starring these teenagers that are making this really elaborate parody about, again, obscene drawings, end up saying more about the way that we stereotype people and how we pigeonhole them than any of those docuseries did. I mean, that really surprised me. And those kids who are, you know, none of them are well-known actors before this show, are really like natural, unaffected performers. I think I've never seen anyone more convincingly be like a kind of loser high school kid.
That's great.
In a way I really related to, of course, than these
don't
two boys.
Don't we all? So yeah, exactly.
That was great.
Let me read some more comments. A tweet from Shelley. She liked Pole Dark. A tweet from Jacqueline. Why hasn't anyone mentioned Stranger Things? A tweet from Hugh. Stranger Things. A tweet from Gail. Love The Good Place. I tell my friends to watch it. Let me just let Stranger Things hang out there. And I want to go back to you, Sonia, to one of your picks. And this is The Crown, season two of Netflix historical drama The Crown. It's about the early life of Queen Elizabeth II. And this scene is a flash forward to 1957. She discusses her unhappy marriage with her husband, Philip, and their tumultuous relationship being heavily scrutinized by the press. They're struggling to find a way out in a time when divorce is not considered an option. Let's give it a listen.
I realize this marriage has turned out to be something quite different to what we both imagined.
Understatement.
And that we find ourselves in a
prison.
A situation that is unique. The exit route, which is open to everyone else.
Divorce.
Yes. Divorce. It's not an option for us. Ever. So what would make it easier on you? To be in, not out. What will it take?
You're asking my price.
I'm asking what it will take.
And that's a scene from The Crown. Sonia, you like this. I like this very much. And I thought, wow, it really humanized the royal family. And I don't think that's an easy thing to do.
It's really not. I mean, when you step back from this drawing, there's this moment where you're like, this is one of the most powerful people in the world who's like really, really rich. Like, why do I care so
exactly.
much about her marriage? but then when you're in it, and I think that a lot of credit goes to the performers and to the writer Peter Morgan. It's so heartbreaking. So much of this show, just in terms of describing the compromises between, you know, individual freedom and a sense that this sense of duty that goes far beyond just one person and is this. It's like the weight of generations and of history, and it's really something that this show is unabashedly monarchist, but it's really a duty that is hard to comprehend, and as some of the politicians say in the show, it's a sacred duty, and so it's it's complex. I mean, as an American, we have it's nice to watch because there's so little investment. Like, we're like, oh, these people are very interesting. I imagine if you're British, it feels a little bit different.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But certainly the performances are just phenomenal. I mean, I feel like I talk up Claire Foy in this show every chance I get because she's an extraordinary performer. You can hear how clipped and patrician her voice is as she's playing Elizabeth in that scene. And then Matt Smith, who most people know as Doctor Who, plays the very, like, gruff and entitled Prince Philip in that scene. And I think they're both so committed to playing these characters that are actually very stiff and really not modern at all. I mean, they come from this bubble of privilege. You know, Elizabeth really relates mostly to horses and to dogs, and she doesn't really understand other people. And Philip is a boarding school boy. You know, he's used to everything being settled with like a feat of strength of some kind. And for them to try to figure out how to be married in publicly in a world that's very rapidly changing around them, in a world where the monarchy means different things from what it used to, it's really heartbreaking because their feelings are there and are part of it. But then also they are all constantly performing to the world more than just. That, you know, I think that the show does a really good job of separating a history that, you know, when you tell true stories, there isn't always a neat arc. It doesn't always end in a nice, neat bow. And so I really like that Peter Morgan separates the different themes of this period of time into chapters, and it feels,
you know what, Sonia, only because we have to take a very short break. My complaint, not enough corgis, but stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about, frankly, too much good TV with Sonia Saraya, TV critic for Variety, and Sam Adams, senior editor of Slate's culture blog, Browbeat. And we want to hear from you, the TV shows that you enjoyed this year. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYY Radio Times. Sam, I do want to play Good Place, The Good Place, something, a show that was on your list. Also a tweet from Stephen. The Good Place is sweet, funny, and philosophically interesting. Noah Hawley continues to be amazing with Legion and Fargo. The Leftovers was incredible, as was Mindhunter. Too much great TV. But let me pick up on The Good Place. And this is a scene from episode 3, season 2. Ted Danson plays Michael. He's created an afterlife for Eleanor, played by Kristen Bell. Let's give it a listen, and then I'll give you a chance, Sam, to respond.
We're on the same page. I want to team up with you guys.
What? Why? You do? What?
I'm in a bit of a bind, and I could use some backup. So, what do you say? New best friends?
You want to team up? You've been torturing us and lying about it.
Oh, let's not get all caught up on who lied to whom or which one of us created an entire fake reality in order to cause eternal misery for the others. That's ancient history.
It was happening until 20 seconds ago.
The point is that circumstances have changed, and now all of us teaming up is our best option.
So sitcom about the afterlife, Sam, is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's very easy, you know, because there's so much, you know, kind of this, you know, quote unquote peak TV stuff going on cable and kind of premium networks. It's easy to kind of let that always be your favorite or, you know, take over everything that you watch. But one of the things I love about The Good Place is that it is, in a lot of ways, a very traditional sitcom. And it features, there's a very specific kind of traditional sitcom acting that people like Ted Danson and Kristen Bell, who you hear in that scene, are just absolutely the best at. I mean, you played that moment in that clip where she says, you know, what? Wait, you do? Why? I mean, she goes through, I've replayed that moment like dozens of times because she goes through four entirely distinct facial expressions in like a second and a half. And it's just, I'm just in awe of that at every moment. So it's, As the person who tweeted it, you mentioned it has these, the show is about the afterlife. It's about kind of, good and evil. And one of the characters is a late, because they're all dead, a professor of moral ethics. So it deals with, it's a sitcom that kind of name drops Kierkegaard, and then we'll have a fart joke in the same episode. So it really plays both
those
ends against
the middle.
No. So it's really, I love that about it. It's, smart and funny and does all the things that traditional sitcoms do, but also has this really amazing ongoing plot line. It's consistently surprising. It's done this kind of classical TV thing where it started off with, two solid characters and has really matured into more of an ensemble show. And it's just, I wanted to rewatch, a little bit of everything on my list last night. And I just, not for the first time, ended up watching Good Place episodes for like 2 hours because it's just so much fun to keep.
And it's on network television. We should remember that.
Yeah, it's on network. The last five episodes are on Hulu. It's coming back again in a couple weeks on NBC for the end of its second season and was renewed for a third. Definitely worth catching up with if you haven't watched it yet.
A tweet from Megan: I love watching Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events with my kids. Baskets, The Good Place, Last Week, Tonight with John Oliver, The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt were on my must-watch list, too. A tweet from Andrew: it's criminal how little attention it seems Mr. Robot is getting from viewers. Such an amazing show. Do you like that show, Sonia?
Oh, that's another one.
I think we got your answer there.
I really liked it for so long, and then it kind of lost me in the second season, and I just haven't picked up yet to check in on the third season. I've heard great things. I believe everyone. But just the list of shows that your viewers are telling us, Mindhunter, which is, these are shows that are hours and hours and hours long, and it's amazing to me how many people are watching all these things. I haven't caught up on them.
Fair enough. A true confession there. A tweet says, the Israeli show Fauda, I heard this was great. This is coming from one of our listeners. Hope this season it's released with the dubbing as an option. I felt the actors were so intense. It's almost impossible to dub without losing sharpness. The show is all about jagged, sharp edges. It's called Fauda. A comment from Deborah: underrated but consistently excellent Longmire. A stellar cast, including Lou Diamond Phillips, and great writing. Who doesn't love those majestic scenes of the West? And as I said, I'll put in my pitch once again for Godless, just because I thought it had everything that a Western should have, including those beautiful vistas, a town of widows because their husbands all died, or mostly all died, in a mining accident. You've got all the wonderful Western cliches. You've got a really good bad guy. You've got a really good guy. So I checked all the boxes when it came to Godless. Sonia, let me go back to you and let's go to The Leftovers. This is the HBO The Leftovers. We have episode 2 of season 3. Nora is played by Carrie Coon, an investigator for the Department of Sudden Departure, investigating why 2% of the world's population vanished in 2011. She's speaking with a widow played by Brett Butler, who claims to have seen her husband vanish in the sudden departure of October 2011.
Can you please describe your relationship to the missing person?
He was my husband.
Your husband, what was he doing up there on that pillar?
Is that on your little questionnaire, too?
No, I was just curious.
Guess.
What?
Guess. What do you think he was doing up there?
I think it was an elaborate coping mechanism.
Coping mechanism? For what?
For whatever pain he was suffering.
Honey, he wanted to suffer. He settled for the pillar only after we got arrested trying to crucify him. I got one nail in before those f***ers had me in cuffs, free country, my ass. But that pillar did the trick just fine. He stayed up there in the rain and the cold and the burning sun, and he ate and he peed up there. He never came down, never touched another person. Not even his own wife. That man never wavered. He proved himself to God. And last night he got his reward.
You saw him depart?
Yes, ma'am. He looked so calm and at peace, and all of a sudden he just kind of faded out like he was on a dimmer, and he was gone, and it was beautiful.
Sonia, you call this an 8-episode wonder.
Yeah, well, the kicker of that is that the woman is lying, which I
just
think
to
is,
add to the drama. Yes,
it does. Yeah, I mean, The Leftovers is such a weird show, and again, I'm leaning on weird, but because this is its third season and its final season that aired this year, and it started out in a different place from where it ended up. It's a show about that speculates on what might happen if 2% of the world's population just vanished. Mm-hmm. And what happens is that its characters are thrown into a crisis, a moral crisis, a spiritual crisis, because of this loss. Different characters lose different things. Nora, who Carrie Coon's character, who's the interrogator in that scene, lost her entire family. And I think that the process of trying to cope with this has made for a show that, by its third season, is really it's so striking. It's beautiful, because so much of the way that we interpret what's wrong in the world is not just emotional, but of course spiritual and philosophical. And these very mundane characters who are cops and psychologists and not exactly anyone whose job it is to grapple with this stuff are sort of forced to deal with these really intense things. And then of course the world around them it has more mystery than it turned out to be. It has more mystery than they ever expected, and so they have to deal with that too. It ends in a really beautiful way. The Damon Lindelof, who did the show, got a chance to end it with this third season, and so it's nice to, very rare in this era of TV, something to have a really neat conclusion.
And it made you cry, as you said.
And it did.
Nothing wrong with that. One of my favorite things to do. A tweet from Joe. This is us. My wife and I are hooked. Another tweet. This is us. Putting in two votes for another TV show of the year. This is us. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Talking with our guests, Sam Adams and Sonia Soraya, about some of the TV shows of the year that they enjoyed, and they think you might too. Sam, you brought in Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. This is episode 6 of season 3 of the CW's Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Star and co-creator Rachel Bloom as Rebecca Bunch, speaking to a new mental health professional following a suicide attempt. Throughout the series, Rebecca has struggled with mental health issues. Let's give it a listen.
Rebecca, in my opinion, you've been misdiagnosed over the years. It's one of the main reasons you've been struggling. I think with the right diagnosis and treatment, you can get a lot better.
Wait, so you have a new diagnosis for me? So I'm not anxious or OCD or depressed or any of the vague combo of things people have told me I am. Oh my God, what am I?
Great questions, but I don't want to get ahead of treatment. Okay, we're going to talk about all that and the steps towards your recovery later today at the clinic.
Wow, this is huge.
I'll see you then, okay?
Okay. Bye. Paula, did you hear what he said? I have a new diagnosis, a new one. He just opened up a whole new future of possibilities for me, a new path for my life.
For almost 30 years, I've known something was wrong, but Mom said weakness causes bloating, so I tried to be strong. Fake it till you make it, that's how I got by. When I tried to find the reason for my sadness and terror, all the solutions were trial and error. Take this pill, say this chant, move here for this guy. But now there's no need for regret, 'cause I'm about to get a diagnosis, a diagnosis. Don't tell me no, sister.
Oh, I like that, Sam. Go ahead.
Yeah,
tell us about Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Well, that clip actually sets it up very well. I was worried I would have to describe the premise of the show, which is a little difficult, especially because it is not only, you know, kind of a low-rated show. It is the lowest-rated show on television. I have friends who pay closer attention to the numbers have said it may actually be the lowest-rated show in the history of network television.
Is it just you watching it then?
It's me and a lot of very happy TV critics. I mean, you know, it's got a very fierce, devoted audience, which is more important to networks and ratings in some cases now, which is one of the reasons why it's still on the air and in its third season. It is, as you hear, a kind of a musical dramedy, I guess, about a woman who kind of throws away her entire successful life in New York and moves to the kind of middle of nowhere in Southern California to chase after this high school crush. And the kind of, you know, secret strength of the first two seasons was that the, you know, the crazy in the title, which, I mean, the title kind of put a lot of people off at first because Crazy Ex-Girlfriend is kind of a misogynist slur. But the secret of the show is that the crazy is not a metaphor, that this is actually someone who's struggled with mental health issues her whole life. And that's really come to the fore in the third season and gotten up to the point where, spoiler alert, Rebecca is diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. And that is about to take the show into a whole new era. They've kind of done this thing where Josh is the guy that she moved there for. And literally every episode title in the first 2.5 seasons had Josh's name in it somewhere. And they just did their first episode with another man's title, name in a title. So she's finally getting over it. And they're kind of moving into this new era. And I think some of the dramatic turns in the third season have not totally come off for me. I don't think that. I think there's a kind of better tension when it's kind of playing against the silliness of the musical numbers. But I really, it's just such a brave and interesting show. And I know, I mean, I've seen amazing testimonies to the way that people who've, you know, dealt with mental illness themselves or in their families are reacting to the show and the things that it's dealing with.
Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. We're almost out of time. Sonia, in about 30 seconds, anything in 2018 that you're looking forward to?
Oh my gosh, there are so many things I'm looking forward to. Well, I'll tell you quickly that there's a new Howard's End adaptation coming to Stars. It stars Hayley Atwell, I think it's Matthew McFadyen. I'm really, really looking forward to it because I'm a really big fan of Howard's End. And it's really nice to see something classic come to TV like that.
How about for you, Sam?
I mean, there's a lot, but I think I'm really looking forward to the final season of The Americans. That's been one of my favorite shows, and
mine
too. Sort of took a dip in the last season, I felt, but it really felt like they were setting up something big in this sixth and final season. So I'm really looking forward to whatever it has in store.
Sam Adams, Sonia Saraya, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times to talk about the TV of 2017. And we do want to close things out with Cold Little Heart by Michael Kinanuka, the theme from HBO's Big Little Lies.